Welcome to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. It's Friday, April 6, 2012. I'm Mickey Huff here in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's show, Fukushima and the cascading impact of nuclear power on the planet. We'll begin the program today talking about recent news stories surrounding the ongoing nuclear crisis in Japan. We'll play a pre-recorded interview with Professor Akira Murakami, professor of North American culture and media literacy at Akita University, who was recently in the San Francisco Bay Area at the behest of the Ecological Options Network. At the bottom of the hour, it's Steve Zeltzer with Workweek Radio. We'll conclude the show specifically dealing with the nuclear industry and health issue as we engage in conversation with Joseph Mangano and Jeanette Sherman, authors of An Unexpected Mortality Increase in the United States Follows Arrival of the Radioactive Plume from Fukushima. Is there a correlation? This was recently published in the International Journal of Health Services. Welcome back to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff here in studio with Peter Phillips. We'd like to take this opportunity to briefly give you all an update on some of Project Censored's latest research from the Media Freedom Foundation. And what we do at the project, people know we do a book each year on underreported news stories, the type of stories that you may be accustomed to hearing on KPFA, but are not heard many other places, certainly not in the corporate news media, not even in other public media outlets for that matter. So we have a process that we do called validated independent news, and we have professors and students around the country and in fact around the world that help do research validating independent news and looking at for its accuracy and sourcing and fact-based nature. And we have students then looking into where these stories are or are not covered, and then faculty experts looking over the potential veracity of these types of stories. And here's Peter Phillips to talk about a few of what we find to be some of the most significant ones, and then we're going to go into our focus on Fukushima. Peter?
Okay, thanks, Mickey. Jane Petras wrote a piece called The Massacre of the Afghan 17 and the Obama Cover-Up, which appeared in Information Clearinghouse on March 27th. We reviewed this at Sonoma State and evaluated the information. Petras writes that on March 11th, 2012, the massacre of the 17 Afghan citizens was just one of several hundred committed by U.S. armed forces, according to President Karzai. Obama's deliberate lies about the events surrounding the massacre and the fundamental responsibility of the high military command committed by the troops underscores the breakdown of the occupation in Afghanistan. The president himself is a major player in this role in the cover-up. Now, according to the U.S. military and the Obama regime, at 3 a.m. on March 11, 2012, a deranged soldier walked off the Special Forces base in rural Kandahar province without command authority, entered two villages 2 miles apart, shot and killed 17 unarmed civilians, mostly women and children, wounded an unspecified number of villagers, and doused their bodies with gasoline, set them on fire, and hiked back to base to surrender to his commanders. The surrender, the Pentagon claims, was recorded on video. The president has vouched for its authenticity as a conclusive proof that there was a lone mass murderer. The military quickly whisked the initial the person unnamed at that time out of Afghanistan to a maximum security prison in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and then identified him as a 38-year-old multi-decorated Army veteran Sergeant Robert Bales. According to independent Afghan parliamentary investigation, who interviewed residents of the villages, there was significant contradiction of the U.S. military and Obama's story. Eyewitnesses have testified that up to 20 soldiers were involved, aided by helicopter, and what they were described as a U.S. Special Forces night raid, which involved a systematic breaking down of doors, rousing sleeping families, and shooting Afghan victims. The villages where the murders occurred were 2 miles apart, making it highly unlikely that a lone soldier could haul gasoline and carry it from one base, waking people up there, shooting the victims, burning them, and then hiking 2 miles more to the second village and shoot and kill people there. When the implausibility of this first story became evident, the Obama public relations people released a new version on March 26. According to the revised version of events, the lone deranged Sergeant Bales committed the first massacre in the early morning hours of March 11th, walked back to base for breakfast and lunch, and then walked out again to a second village for another round of mass murder before returning and turning himself into his commander posing for the video. Also coming to news that we've looked at this week is a small number of corporations run the global economy. This is an interesting study from the University of Zurich. Reports how banks primarily are the huge power base inside the global economy. This is a study completed at the Swiss Federal Institute in Zurich. The study took a look at 43,000 transnational corporations and their interconnectedness and created a map of 1,300 that were at the heart of this global economy, and they narrowed it down to 147 companies that formed a super entity within this group, and they control 40% of the wealth in the world. Number one, Barclays Bank, which is part of BlackRock International out of New York, which is a $3.3 trillion investment company there. So when we talk about the 1%, we have some pretty good ideas who those are involved. Our affiliate university from Project Censored in Madrid has two reports. One is that the number of casualties in Iraq now exceeds those who've died in Vietnam. They're saying, according to ViewZone, war deaths, that they look at U.S. military records, and if they were counting the number of deaths the same way that they did in Vietnam, that in fact there would be 15,000 more U.S. casualties in the war in Iraq than happened in Vietnam. So apparently the way casualties are counted, they quickly exit the country and move on and die elsewhere. So this is an interesting story. Coming also from our university in Madrid, targeted killing of Iraq university professors persists. It is now evidence, according to the official website, Spanish Campaign Against the Occupation for the Sovereignty of Iraq, has said that over the past several years, 317 academics at various universities have been assassinated. So these are important news stories that are available on the Project Censored website under Validated News. Mickey?
Thanks, Peter. Those stories are available at projectcensored.org. They're also available real-time for Validated Independent News updates at mediafreedominternational.org. And we'll keep you posted on more of the stories we're looking at for the Censored 2013 news cycle. Well, the subject of today's program, other than underreported news in general, we have, of course, some specificity. As announced at the Billboard, we're looking at Fukushima and the cascading impact of nuclear power on the planet. Story number 8 from Censored 2012, which was researched at San Francisco State University under Professor Ken Burrows and student Aaron Peacock, looked at the fairy tale of clean, safe nuclear power. Again, this was one of the top 10 underreported stories from Censored 2012. It was a series of 4 different publications, one from the Union of Concerned Scientists, another from Nuclear Information and Resources, that talked about, of course, how nuclear energy is not safe and is also extremely expensive both financially and environmentally. The new issue of Nuke Watch Quarterly reminds us, this is from spring 2012, just in the past year, we had major floodwaters being held back at Nebraska's Fort Calhoun reactor, 19 miles from Omaha. So we had an incident there. There was a massive fire that engulfed Russia's 550-foot nuclear-powered submarine that burned for over 20 hours out of control and had 64 nuclear warheads on it. There is an event in France where there was a transformer that exploded in southern France. And at that same facility, there were over 60,000 drums of deadly waste. Those were stored at the site. And of course, the subject of today and the aftermath of this event was the 9.0 earthquake that struck off the coast of Japan, destroying 4 of the 6 reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi complex. So these are major stories about nuclear power, nuclear energy, and the grave risk, really, that they put humanity at, put life on the planet. Over the past year, we've covered stories on how the EPA and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission basically are involved getting sending nuclear industry lobbyists to monitor radiation. We've covered stories on food safety and how the government has failed both in Japan and the U.S. trying to deal with food safety and Fukushima radiation contamination. Harvey Wasserman most recently wrote at BuzzFlash and Truthout that there are two nuclear reactors in the U.S. that were on par to come online, but not so fast, says Wasserman. There is resistance to these. There is a growing resistance to what he says is the myth of nuclear renaissance. So again, these are all important stories, but if you were watching the corporate media, you'd probably not hear too much about them. Later on the program, we're going to hear about a story about how there are over 14,000 U.S. deaths possibly tied to Fukushima reactor disaster fallout. So again, these are very serious stories, underreported stories, and we're here to bring them to you today. For our first segment here, we turn to an interview. Again, 13 months after the nuclear meltdown at Japan's Fukushima power plant, the government there declared that it had the stricken plant had last been brought under control. It's finally okay. But as this goes on and on and on, and even as recently as this week, authorities are admitting over and over that radioactive water is still leaking into the oceans, and we are now even seeing debris washing up along the west coast of the United States containing radioactive particulates. Again, Fukushima is one of the more than 50 nuclear power plants in Japan, and recently an expert on media from Japan, Professor Akira Murakami of our Akira University, spoke with Workweek Radio's Steve Zeltzer about how nuclear power was sold to the Japanese population. We give thanks to Dr. Andy Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, for helping set up the interview, and Anthony Fest for helping produce. Here is the interview with Professor Akira Murakami.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Project Censored on The Morning Mix, and joining me this morning is Akira Murakami. He's a professor in Japan. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Professor Murakami, maybe you can talk about yourself and what you do in Japan, mm-hmm. what kind of studies you do.
I have been an activist scholar for more than 30 years, studying about human rights and environmental issues. And I happened to buy a copy of Alexei Yablokov's book on Chernobyl accident, Chernobyl, consequences of the catastrophe for people and the environment, issued by the New York Academy of Science before the accident. So I knew what would happen to us. We had an accident.
And Japan has had nuclear power for many, many years.
Yes.
Why are there 54 plants, nuclear power plants in Japan?
It's a long story. Can I trace back to its first stage? Just after the Second World War, we looked up to the United States as superpower in the field of science and technology, in the field of industry and economy. After all, we were beaten by the United States. Then came President Eisenhower making his famous speech, Atoms for Peace, at the General Assembly of the United Nations. We were attracted to the ideas of peace and scientific development, and almost forgetting about what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We totally separated two events, I mean, nuclear arms and nuclear power generation. And we were quite happy about nuclear power generation introduced in Japan. Some of the audience might remember the animated cartoon characters, Astro Boy. Go, go, Astro Boy. In the Japanese language, his name is Tetsuman Atom. Iron Limbed Atom. His name is Atom. And he has a small reactor in his chest, and his sister's name is Uran. Uran is the Japanese equivalent for uranium. These names clearly show that we are attracted and tricked into believing that nuclear power promised a bright future, but a bright future for us. But in fact, it was introduced to support nuclear armament, technically and financially. And on the 16th of August last year, ex-minister of defense, Shigeru Ishiba, told us in an interview, said Japan is the only one country that has been promoting nuclear power generation without the pursuit for nuclear arms. But we can be rearmed with nuclear bombs by making use of technology and material we are using for nuclear power generation. And this means that nuclear power reactors are not a problem of energy, but it's a military issue. We are only doing it for the nuclear deterrent.
Now, the Fukushima nuclear meltdown, mm-hmm. you live in the northern part of Japan.
Yes.
Facing the Japanese Sea.
Mm-hmm.
What happened on that day, March 11th, and how were you affected personally?
Personally, I was waiting for my plane at Tokyo International Airport. But the very first thing popped up in mind was nuclear plants constructed along the coast of the Pacific Ocean. And my guess was unfortunately right. And when I flew to Vietnam and checked the internet, they were saying that Japan might end in a few days. But when I came back to Japan, everything was in peace and quiet. They didn't care almost anything about the reactors. So much information has been kept a secret. And again, we were duped into believing that nothing has happened. Almost nothing has happened. But they were doing it to make this collective crime look smaller.
And the government did not let people know that plans were being drawn up possibly for the evacuation of mm-hmm. Tokyo. That actually they were concerned that the explosions at the plant would lead to contamination of that whole area mm-hmm. and also other nuclear plants in that region. Were you shocked to find out that the government did not tell you the truth about what was going on?
No. I had expected our government to go that way because we've had so many cover-up cases. For example, so many cover-up cases, small accidents came to light. So the next year, TEPCO or Tokyo Electric had to shut down, had to put all their reactors taken offline for a certain period of time for inspection. But we didn't have any power shortage problems. We wouldn't be surprised to see that to face new cover-up cases.
Now, the government regulatory agencies in Japan that regulate the nuclear industry, mm-hmm. Are they similar to those in the United States in which industry has a very big say as far as regulation? I mean, in other words, TEPCO has some real influence.
Uh-huh. They are the same in that. The industry has a big say, but the system is a little bit different. Our regulatory commission and the sector that promotes nuclear power built in the same MITI, Keizai Sangyosho, almost close to each other.
So the promoters of nuclear energy in Japan mm-hmm. and the government are in the same building.
Yes.
With those people who are supposed to regulate nuclear industry. And there has been an occupation by women, mothers mm-hmm. of Fukushima, mm-hmm. at that
in front of that ministry, yes.
Have you been to that occupation?
No.
I see.
Because up there in Akita, so many women, so many mothers are worried about their children. And I have been giving lectures on the danger of internal exposure for these women with so much so serious concerns about their children's health.
And initially the government and even doctors mm-hmm. said there was no immediate danger. For radioactivity.
That's right.
What kind of language is that that there's no immediate danger. What are they trying to say to calm people?
Mm. In a sense, they are telling the truth because we might not have immediate health effects, but in 5 or 10 years from now, we might get cancer. But they are emphasizing no immediate health effects, minimizing the danger of future cancer or other serious diseases.
Now, there are 300,000 children mm-hmm. in Fukushima, and many of the families there have mm-hmm. wanted to evacuate. But apparently the government has not provided them compensation to evacuate if they want to evacuate. What is the situation of these children?
They have two kinds of information. Information provided by the government and the media, and information coming from activists like me. And sometimes these two kinds of information tear away communities, families, even couples. So perhaps 20 or 30% of the residents in Fukushima might want to be evacuated. But a majority of the Fukushima residents are still thinking that they'll be all right living in the same towns and cities, eating the same food, complying with Buy Fukushima, Eat Fukushima campaign.
And what is behind this Buy Fukushima, Eat Fukushima campaign?
The government, the media, the industry, plus mouthpiece scholars whom I tentatively call mouthpiece professors. I mean, mouthpiece of the government.
So the government is engaged in, from what you're saying, in a propaganda
cover-up
of what's really going on and the yes. dangers to the Japanese people of Fukushima.
Right. And at Akita University, I'm the only one who is giving lectures for fear-stricken mothers.
And these children who are being contaminated, are there any signs that have been discovered of iodine in their urine or other mm-hmm. Problems, medical problems that they're having?
Yes, bleeding from nostrils, skin diseases, short-temperedness, and cardiovascular diseases. They are in the news, but news in the internet, news in the cyberspace, not on television.
Have you been interviewed on NHK or Japanese national television?
No. Probably I'm the last one to be interviewed in Akita Prefecture.
So they're not interested in putting your voice on the television?
I'm honored to be your guest.
Now, how did the families, the mothers, the school workers discover that, in fact, their area was contaminated? How did that take place?
And nowadays, news information come out to foreign countries and come back from foreign countries. So if you connect yourself to the cyberspace, you can have so much information of the right kind.
And they had to buy Geiger counters and dosimeters to find out if their area was contaminated?
Yes. Japanese people living in any part of the country would like to have detector that can detect a very small amount of radiation, especially in the food they eat. Because our food regulations are quite loose, and we have only spot inspections. So chances are that we might have highly contaminated daikon horseradish in a cardboard box, which is not very contaminated as a whole.
What are the lessons for the people of the United States about mm-hmm. the Fukushima disaster, and what can Americans do in solidarity with the Japanese people?
Please be careful about the food you eat And please be careful about the contamination of the environment. But most importantly, please make every effort to shut down the remaining nuclear reactors before it's too late. This planet couldn't afford another Chernobyl or another Fukushima.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for joining us, Akira Murakami.
Thank you very much.
The atomic age was born. There is no denying that since that moment, the shadow of the atom bomb has been across all our lives. All men of goodwill earnestly hope that a realistic control of atomic weapons can and will be achieved. Meanwhile, good sense requires that all of us prepare for any eventuality. But wisdom demands, too, that we take time to understand this force. Because here, in fact, is the answer to a dream as old as man himself. A giant of limitless power at man's command. And where was it science found that giant? In the atom. A particle so infinitely small that it takes over 100 billion atoms to make up the head of a pin. Just as other millions and quadrillions of atoms are the tiny.
That is from a 1952 short film created by General Electric, one of the manufacturers of the reactors in Fukushima, Japan. Thanks to Steve Zeltzer for that interview. And up next, we hear from Steve again with Work Week Radio. And then we'll be back to talk to Jeanette Sherman and Joseph Mangano about their recent study on unexpected mortality increases in the U.S. following the Fukushima radioactive plume. Here's Work Week Radio.
Journalists under attack as police become militarized and government spying and intimidation become the norm. The growing militarization of the U.S. police forces is not only being used against workers and activists, but journalists who are now being targeted for even covering government repression and violation of human rights. The escalation of these attacks began after the 9/11 incident, which was used as a pretext by President Bush and the Congress to pass more and more repressive legislation, including the Patriot Act and other laws eliminating democratic rights. Thousands of travelers are now denied the right to travel on airlines for suspicion but no conviction of any crime. Machines now take intrusive photographs in order to get on an airplane. The massive multi-billion dollar spying operation that the U.S. runs is bringing us closer to a police state with intense scrutiny of any and all communication that we have from the use of phones, electronic mail, and social media web pages. Employers as well around the country are now demanding the password to Facebook pages to see if you're the proper fit in their company. The same Supreme Court that ruled that the Patriot Act was legal has ruled that anyone stopped for a traffic infraction violation can potentially be strip searched. The systemic attack on democratic rights is not only directed against activists and the public, but journalists. Independent blogger and videographer Josh Wolf was thrown in prison mostly in solitary confinement for over 6 months for refusing to surrender a video he shot of a 2005 San Francisco rally to law enforcement. The federal government said that since the video was shot on federal property, they had a right to get his video. It was shot during a clash on the streets of San Francisco between San Francisco police officers and anti-G8 protesters, in which a police car was burned. Many states are also now making it a crime to even videotape police arrests and actions making it easier to cover up their possible violations of the law. Recently in Berkeley, the police chief Michael Meehan ordered a visit to Bay Area News Group reporter Doug Oakley early in the morning to make a correction on a story. The mayor and politicians in Berkeley still have not even placed the police chief on leave. It is business as usual for this violation of democratic rights. At the University of California, the militarization of the police by the corporate-controlled regents has been combined as well with an attack on journalists who are covering protests on the campus. This violation of civil rights has now become the norm, and this was especially the case with the national police effort to close down the Occupy Wall Street movement. Prior to the police attack on Occupy Oakland, a national call was held with police officials of the Obama administration and local mayors around the country, including Oakland Mayor Kwan. The national plan to attack peaceful protesters and evict them from their camps led to the organized police riot in Oakland and the shooting of peaceful protesters, including Iraqi veteran Scott Olson. Alongside this assault was the attack on both journalists from both the mainstream press and independent journalists. in Oakland, one of the flagrant attacks on journalists, according to the CWA, which represents most professional journalists in the U.S., was the Oakland police cornering, with guns, a Pacifica Media Workers Guild, TNG CWA, 39521 member and photographer Ray Chavez of the Oakland Tribune. He was, quote, held at weapon point by two police officers in riot gear. They grabbed at his camera, breaking off the flash and throwing it to the ground, according to Guild representative Sarah Steffens. As he continued to work, he was bruised by non-lethal weaponry, either tear gas canister, beanbags, or rubber bullets, unquote. These attacks on journalists and videographers are increasing. In Santa Cruz, Indy Bay reporter Bradley Stewart Allen is being charged with felony conspiracy in his coverage of the Occupy movement. The police actually said that he was not a journalist because he did not interview the police. The labor movement, all trade unions, and all working people need to defend journalists who are covering the struggles going on throughout the Bay Area, around the country, and internationally. This is not only about civil rights, but the right of the American people to get an accurate and honest picture of what is really going on in our society. The fact that these Bay Area police, who have blatantly violated journalists' rights, are still on the police force is further evidence that far from opposing these attacks on the press, politicians are complicit by failing to make these police accountable. This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek Radio, and now we go to our calendar.
This is the Workweek calendar for the week of April 6, 2012. On Saturday, April 7th at noon, there will be an Occupy Education meeting at Unite Here Local 2 at 209 Golden Gate Avenue in San Francisco. For more information, visit OccupyEducationCA.org. On Saturday, April 7th, between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m., there will be informational picketing by Golden Gate Bridge workers for a decent contract. The protest will be at Golden Gate Park Concourse, which is to hold a salute on the 75th anniversary. The workers have been without contract for many months, and Golden Gate Bridge Board Chair Janet Riley and others are demanding major concessions. On Tuesday, April 10th, at San Francisco State, there will be a teach-in on Wells Fargo, the attack on homeowners, and SEIU 87 janitors, who will be taking a strike vote. The meeting will be between 6:30 p.m. and 9 p.m. at San Francisco State University in room HUM 587. For more information, visit ifg.org. On Thursday, April 12th, there will be an all-day siege at the Hotel Frank in San Francisco from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The hotel has fired union stewards and activists of Unite Here Local 2 and is seeking to break the union. The hotel is located at Geary and Mason Street near Union Square. For more information, visit hotelfranksf.info. On Friday, April 13th in San Jose, the California Federation of Teachers will be having a statewide convention and a labor march with music to San Jose City Hall. The mayor has launched a major attack on AFS, CME, and other San Jose workers' pensions and benefits. The march will start at 11 a.m. at Plaza de Cesar Chavez at 170 South Market Street. For more information, call 408-597-7649, extension 2575, or visit atwork.org. On Saturday, April 14th, the Erotic Service Providers Union will be having a benefit and fundraiser for legal funds and to end the war on whores by gaining sexual freedom for commercial sex workers and their customers, but also for the larger public. The benefit will be held at The Parkside at 1600 17th Street in San Francisco at 9 p.m. For more information on the benefit, visit espu-ca.org. On April 21st, there will be the annual Cesar Chavez Parade in San Francisco to commemorate and celebrate the life and work of labor and civil rights leader Cesar Chavez. Assemble for the parade at Dolores Park at 19th Street and Guerrero at 11 a.m. The parade will end at 24th Street Fair from noon to 6 p.m. For more information, go to CesarChavezDay.org. If you have events for the labor calendar, send them to info@workweekradio.org. This is Erica Lucarati with Workweek Radio.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Jim Menzel Joseph, host of the Art of Survival show on the Progressive Radio Network. Together, we will share a journey of discovery and a vision of creating a sustainable future for ourselves and for our planet. Tune in Sundays, 3 p.m. Eastern, or catch us on the archives 24/7. If you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where we talk about my favorite subject, food. Learn how you can make a positive difference in your life and all life on Earth every time you eat. To listen to the show, go to prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, this is Professor T. Love of A Bowl of Soul, a mixed stew of soul music. Come get your history lesson in soul music on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Ow. Tune in as I play soul music from 1949 to the present. Also, listen to A Bowl of Soul in the archives. If you like A Bowl of Soul, rate us in iTunes. Come and catch a groove on A Bowl of Soul. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at prn.fm.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward,
and we
want
you
to
come
with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. We hope you'll join us on our new time slot for our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com on Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time and 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Sometimes a fever's not a bad thing.
Dreaming is really important to our health.
Laughter's the best medicine.
We should use our common sense.
If you miss our live show, you can always catch us on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com archives.
Also, if you like our show, please rate us on iTunes.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff here in studio with Peter Phillips. We continue our theme today, Fukushima and the cascading impact of nuclear power on the planet. Our next guests are Joseph Mangano and Jeanette Sherman, authors most recently of an article titled An Unexpected Mortality Increase in the United States Follows Arrival of the Radioactive Plume from Fukushima. Is there a correlation? This article was recently published in the International Journal of Health Services. Joseph Mangano has a Master of Public Health and Master of Business Administration, is Executive Director of the Radiation and Public Health Project, a research and education group based in New York. Mangano is a public health administrator and researcher. He has published numerous articles and letters in medical and other journals, in addition to books including Low-Level Radiation and Immune System Disorders, an Atomic Era Legacy. Jeanette Sherman, medical doctor, is a research colleague and lecturer for the Radiation and Public Health Project. She was a researcher at Michigan State University, a part of the Atomic Energy Commission at the University of California, Berkeley, a consultant to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for Toxic Substances Control Act between 1976 and 1982. She is the author of Life's Delicate Balance, Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer, as well as Chemical Exposure and Disease. Her website is JeanetteSherman.com. Joseph and Jeanette, are you with us today?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here too.
Welcome, Joseph. Your research is concerning, of course, for people here in California. You're saying that after 6 days after the earthquake and Fukushima meltdowns, that this radiation plume reached the United States, and the evidence that so far indicates that some 14,000 people, mostly under 1 year of age, have died in relation to that. Can you tell us how you did this study?
Well, we really started it because, the U.S. officials did monitor the plume coming from Fukushima and did certainly detect that it reached the West Coast, really 4 to 6 days after the meltdowns. However, what happened next was rather disappointing. There was, for a few weeks, the Environmental Protection Agency did some measurements of the air and the water and the food, the milk, for radiation levels, and did find some high levels, but most of the results from the EPA were ND, non-detectable, which unfortunately means we really don't know how much got in. And also, several weeks after the meltdown began, the EPA abandoned their program of testing at least every week around the country and went back to their quarterly measurements. So we felt that the third disappointment was to declare all the levels that reached here in the U.S. to be harmless. Well, we felt this was not enough. Janet?
To put it mildly, one of the things that I want to mention is that not only have I written a couple of books on, and you know, the causes of cancer and other illnesses, but I'm the contributing editor to the book called Chernobyl: Consequences of a Catastrophe for People and the Environment. And the senior author of this book, Alexei Yablokov, was here in the United States with me about a week after Fukushima happened. And we did countless numbers of interviews, both on TV and radio, that said Fukushima is going to be worse than Chernobyl. So anybody who wants to know what happened after Chernobyl and what is going to happen now with Fukushima that's still melting down and still has not stopped needs to read this book, because it affected everything from wild animals, domestic animals, plants, fish, birds, bacteria, viruses, everything, including humans, has been affected. So if people want to know what's going to happen after Fukushima, they need to read this book and find out.
Well, it's also the case, we had just heard that there were several disappointing measures after the Fukushima accident. We heard certainly a previous guest in interview with Professor Akira Makurami talking about how the Japanese government wasn't really looking into this and, in fact, is actively censoring information about this. In the U.S., we'd heard that the regulatory agencies weren't looking into this. Greenpeace, of course, took it upon themselves to look into some of the contamination and found that off the coast of Japan, contamination levels were 50 times higher than regular safety limits. We've also seen, even recently, Arnie Gunderson, the nuclear engineer, take 5 random soil samples in Tokyo and found that all 5 were so radioactive that they would be considered radioactive waste in the United States. So
that's correct.
So these are riveting statements, and this Gunderson just did this recently. This you can see this at Fairwinds, their website. It was also published on Washington's blog. Can you comment on that, and what does that mean?
Janet, I'll start.
It you start,
basically
yeah.
means that although we don't know exactly, Fukushima was not just a small meltdown, a leak in a small reactor somewhere in the country. It was one of the two, and quite likely the worst meltdown that ever occurred. And it's still uncontrolled. It's still releasing radiation over a year later. Which the bottom line on that is, no matter how great the emissions, we need to get cracking on health studies in Japan and in other countries, and rather than just assume that these levels are harmless. That's a terribly irresponsible thing for the EPA and others to do.
Well, we also have learned that the sea creatures are now accumulating radioactive materials in their bodies, and this is going to go up the entire food chain from plankton all the way up to, you know, crustaceans and fish, and then any humans who eat it. We also got an email, it's gone over on the internet today, that it looks like that the cesium-137 is at least 85 times higher than the Chernobyl accident. And if the spent fuel rods, which are not safe, they are above the reactors, they are losing water, they need to be covered entirely with water all the time. And if one of these, particularly reactor number 4, fails with the pool rods, this will imperil the entire world with radioactivity. So something, I mean, we're all exercised about Iran having a doing nuclear work, but it may kill the planet if we don't get something done about Fukushima, and it's unsure anything can be done.
You write in your study that several thousand research reports now put the level of death from Chernobyl at over or close to a million.
Right.
And your study here looks at the immediate impacts of death. You're saying 14,000 people have died this year. In excess, and many of those are small children, while at the same time EPA and the government is saying, you know, that there are no long-term, no immediate effects, it's all long-term, it's small doses. Your evidence seems to indicate that's simply not true.
Yeah, you know, the study that we did was not any original one. A quarter century ago, Dr. Jay Gould, who was the founder of our group, did a similar one after Chernobyl, and he found in the first 4 months after Chernobyl something on the order of 20,000 or so. It was like 17,000 deaths in excess of the expected. And we found pretty much the same thing here. You know, first we estimated 14,000. Now we've up to 22,000. But it's the same. There is a mechanism that's going on, and we're still, you know, trying to fully put it together. And Janet, I'll turn it over to you. But where people who are suffering basically from disease and whose immune systems aren't strong, if you add a level of poison, which is what these are, a suffering person may die more quickly than expected. Janet, you're the MD.
Our other concern is the unborn and the newborn children, because the dosages are proportionately larger than they are for an adult. If you're talking about an unborn who's somewhere between, you know, 3.5 to maybe 7 pounds, the dose is higher. And we worried about cesium-137 and strontium-90, the latter going to their bones and teeth, and then the iodine-131 going to the thyroid. A newborn has to have a functioning thyroid, otherwise they will wind up retarded. And these newborns and yet to be born have unfinished immune systems. Their cell turnover is very high compared to an adult. So any exposure to radiation is really life threatening to these.
We're speaking with Joseph Mangano and Janet Sherman, authors of An Unexpected Mortality Increase in the U.S. Follows Arrival of the Radioactive Plume from Fukushima. Is there a correlation? This was recently published in the International Journal of Health Services. You can learn more. We have JanetteSherman.com as a website for that, JanetteSherman.com. To both of you, surely there are critics of some of the numbers that you've come to. Some are saying that this is an alarmist account. How do you respond to some of those types of comments, number one? And two, could you briefly discuss some of the methodology and how you came across, how you deduced these numbers?
Ken, I'll take a shot first at this. The response we usually make from these people is, where are your studies? If this radiation from Japan, which is lower than what the Japanese got, is so safe, where are your studies proving it's safe? And the answer is, there are none. Okay, these are people who just make an assumption that below a certain level, radiation doesn't harm people, which is absolutely scientifically false. We prefer to go out and do the studies before we, assess just what the impact of Fukushima was. And the way we did, the other question is, the way we did this study was, there isn't much data, final data on, you know, disease and death rates right immediately after they occur, with one exception. The Centers for Disease Control puts out a weekly report of deaths from 122 U.S. cities, about a quarter of the country, which is, you know, a rather large sample. And we just compared the weekly changes from 2010 to 2011, before Fukushima and after Fukushima. And there was a jump of about 2% or so, which doesn't sound like much, but when you're talking about, on average, about 2.4 million people in this country die every year, the excess came out to about 14,000, and now we believe it's closer to 22,000. We'll know for sure in a few years when the final numbers come out. But, yeah, simply we just took official CDC data on deaths, and we saw this unusual jump in late March, April, May, and June from 2010 to 2011.
I'd like to address the alarmist radiophobic issue. This is we've been accused of this, and of course, people in the who followed Chernobyl were also accused of raising the alarmist views. But we have to understand that these releases of both Chernobyl and Fukushima have affected life across the board, and it's not just humans. And you can't say that the plants and the birds and the fish and the wildlife were radiophobic, because they don't know. And we did find, we have found our particularly Tim Mousseau, who is a noted researcher, has been to Chernobyl over 25 times, and I think Fukushima two or three. They found changes in the wildlife, in the insects, in the plants, and in the birds. So, as they did find at Chernobyl, and these animals cannot be radiophobic. It's just because their DNA and their cellular mechanisms and their reproduction has been adversely affected.
Jeanette and Joseph, this information that you're providing is vital. It contradicts what the government is telling us. It seems that they don't want us to be alarmed or to be panicked about this. In May of, and this is not just human beings, this impacts the entire environment. Because in May of 86, Dr. David DeSanto was studying birds out at Point Reyes here in California, and identify that two-thirds of the hatchlings that year didn't make it, that died. And so, you know, this is a total environmental issue. We need to continue to take a look at that. Do you have any last words? We're almost out of time here.
Yeah, my last words would be, in addition to the need to really do the studies on Fukushima, the lesson of Fukushima is also what we have here in the U.S. We have 104 nuclear reactors that are still running. They're old, they're aging, they're corroding. And even if there are no meltdowns, every day we release small amounts relatively small amounts of radiation into the environment and into our bodies. So in other words, we get a mini Fukushima every day.
Janet, we have 20 seconds.
Okay, if anybody wants to read the book, it's been reduced from $150 to $10, and they can order it through my website, through the Radiation and Public Health website, or from orders at Greco, G-R-E-K-O, printing.com. And you can read all about it for $10.
Thanks so much for joining us. Joseph Mangano and Dr. Janet Sherman will certainly be watching that. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks, too, to Steve Zeltzer, Anthony Fest, Kirsten Thomas. Thanks to Andy Roth for our interview, too, with Akira Murakami. I have one announcement. Technology, Health, and Society, a conference Saturday, April 7th, that's tomorrow, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the Cesar Chavez Student Center, Rosa Parks Rooms at San Francisco State University. It's a day-long community conference about the effects of technology on personal and public health with Professor Ken Burrows. Please, if you are interested, you can check out more details at the San Francisco State University website. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This has been the Project Censored Show. Thanks for joining us.
All right, getting good grades. The future's so bright. I've got a wish.